I'm going to reassign all those applause to you for showing up tonight. Now, my in-laws were supposed to come. My kids were supposed to come. My wife was supposed to. She did one about a month ago, Children in Room E4, Susan Eaton, great book. I came. Anyway, so you guys are, hey, hi Chris, for real, and it's just wonderful to see you. How many people here are in the middle of a writing project? One, two, three, four, I know about you guys, five, six, anybody else? There are some couples negotiations, seven. I'm going to guess that it's an audience of writers, and I'm going to guess that we would serve you best by speaking relatively briefly and starting a conversation. Does that match your intuition?
Sure.
Okay, but I do want to explain this book a little bit and boast about it. In 1996, while I was writer in residence at BU, I got the foolish idea in mind to try and organize a nonfiction narrative fusion conference. And I imagined everyone showing up from radio documentary makers to and TV broadcast people. It was a little early to anticipate the web flowering that's happened since then. And I expected, since I'd been speaking at some of Poynter's national writers' workshops as a literary journalist talks to daily journalists, it was sort of like over the wall, saying, hey, you can tell some stories in your newspaper. And I expected, and there came some anthropologists, a few historians, people doing non-statistical research methodology broodings in several fields, including sort of practical sociology, sociologies of communication, education, things like that, who are interested in that sort of thing. And all of them came, about 350 people came, but to my astonishment, the press people, printed daily press, flooded in. And I'm slow, but I'm not completely foolish. And I try to understand why, and the conference moved in that direction, and eventually moved across the river to the Nieman Foundation and grew to 50 speakers and 1,000 mid-career journalists. What propelled it was a sense that the voice of news, of conventional news, wasn't doing it anymore. And I have some elaborate theories about that, not all of which I will burden you with tonight, but I may slip in one or two. The one that I have been have enjoyed talking about lately is a complaint about voice, and it's indicative. I give a talk called Why Journalists Talk Funny, and ask people to imagine a situation where you wake up in the middle of the night because you hear fire engines outside, you look out your window, you see they're way down the street, you go back to sleep in the morning in Starbucks, morning where you read your morning paper. You are standing in line, there's a tired-looking guy behind you. He's got his Boston Globe briefcase. And he says, oh, I didn't get any sleep last night, the fire. And I said, oh, did you see it? He says, yeah, it was right outside my window. I put on my slippers and went outside. And you say, what happened? And he says, a fire yesterday at the corner of 3rd and Elm Street destroyed a three-family wood frame house. Damage is estimated at $450,000, according to Associate Fire Chief Charles J. McGillicuddy. So the question is, do you want to talk to this guy? Or do you, you know, look to see whether there are orderlies outside and whether he should be, whether he's dangerous, not just crazy. Okay, but why do journalists speak that way? I think it's in keeping with a traditional role of journalists as our guardians, not our moral guardians, but the city's guardians. They're sentinels. And Sentinels, you can see it in the names of paper, Bugle, Clarion, Tribune, all that sort of thing, Lantern, are low-ranking military. If I'm a private in the military and the corporal says, go look at the enemy machine gun nest, and I come back and say, I haven't seen such blackness since I was a terrified boy hiding under my bed, and by the way, I picked my nose the whole time. He's going to say, but if you, he's in trouble. He's going to go to jail for saying that. But if he says, enemy machine gun emplacement 37 meters south-southwest, sir, four crates of ammunition, he talks funny, but he's going to get a gold medal for that, okay? Meanwhile, what he's not is a little Diogenes out there with his lantern looking for truth. He's not that. Maybe some novelists are that. Maybe some independent nonfiction writers are that. Maybe some poets are that. And maybe some reporters are that. Because I'm simplifying grossly, of course. But what's changed since that voice of honor took shape early in the 1900s, if not sooner, is the public sensibility. The public now understands that the real story is the backstory, and the people's psychology and their bureaucratic ambitions and the power of various parties bear much more truth than the heroic conventions that could be uttered by bronze guys on horseback. TV may have taught us that, not so much the TV news, which is just too powerful to be candid or to break out of that voice, but other parts of TV, NYPD Blue, things like that, the soap operas, which talk about backstory and which educate people not to be satisfied with just a little bit. So meanwhile, newspapers are in terrible trouble, I think partly because chained newspapers monopolize city markets, but stick to that thrifty voice. And a selection of quality papers, say, has adventured with broadening the voice of storytellers to tremendous business effect. And that was the original inspiration for, I think, for the conference to move to the Nieman Foundation, and certainly for me to get the idea of putting this together. Of course, these projects, if they're worth anything, take on multiple sensibilities and lives of their own, and Jay probably has a completely different take, and I hope that he will come out with it. I wish that Emily and Jim were here, because they're also very original in their takes on this. But anyway, the one other thought I'll leave you with is that the conventional Sentinel's news voice restricts the fact set. I mean, you can't talk about hiding under your bed or picking your nose in that voice, or even some other impersonal things. And the emotion set, there are only three or four civic emotions that can be talked about easily in newspapers, and they include things like worry about endangered children and disapproval of crime in the streets and a swelling heart when you see the flag. It makes it hard to be complicated enough to tell the truth. And there's nothing reporters want more to do than tell the truth. So reporters all over are scraping their feet and eager to move in this direction. That I can tell you. And the most knowing, it's a top-down reform at newspapers, though. It takes adjudication of time, and it takes investment, and it takes sophisticated editing. But it's been quite successful where it's happened. And it's also manifest, I'm sure Jay will say, how that level of, that broadened level of sensibility is appearing in broadcast media as never before. So that's the background for this book. Speakers came for many years. We've gone through all of the talks and picked out a little slice here and a little slice there, 9 sections, which you can see for yourself. I'll mutter a few of them. An Invitation to Narrative, Finding Research and Reporting, Name Your Subgenre, which includes travel, personal essay, profiles, history, investigative, etc. Structure, quality, ethics, editing partnerships, fitting this into an organization, and building a career. And within each of these, there are some wonderfully eloquent speakers. I picture people, I will bet that many people who read this read it in spells, in short spells here and there, now and then, but that a lot of people are going to find some little fact in it, or a little element, a little piece of wisdom or something that will straighten out today's snarl. It's a sort of, because of course we look for little illusions of help from the outside, but nothing can help you when you're writing. It's a desperate act, as I'm sure everybody who raised their hand and some who didn't know. Okay, I'm going to read a little bit, just a tiny little bit, a couple of pages about setting the scene, just to give you a sample. I have no idea if I'm going to finish 3 or 4 pages. I doubt it. Set scenes in narrative writing, and you tell me if you have trouble with my voice, and I'll see what I can do about it. Set scenes in narrative writing, whether fiction or nonfiction, should foster the reader's sense of immediacy. That's a sort of rule you can hang on the wall. Does what I just did foster the reader's sense of immediacy? It's kinesthetic. You write, she had a mishap, and readers feel nothing. You write, she stepped out into nothing and pitched downstairs. Readers feel it in their stomachs. You write, she smells roses, and readers do too. You write, she blinked in the bright light, and we squint. Set scenes implicate the reader in the action. Strong scene setting includes several features beyond specifying action, dialogue, and detail. I'll describe a few. One is camera and microphone control. Purposefully or not, the author sets out a camera and microphone. Might as well put them where they help most. They're often set in one spot, but they can move, say, to the shoulder of a main character. The author may reset the range, but must do it with care and intention so the reader can follow, as filmmakers do this often. For example, you can move from the inside to the outside of a home, but it won't do to mix these locations in the same shot. When my wonderful students do that, I say Chagall-like description. Slow motion and fast motion are possible too, as are blinding whiteouts. Sense of volume. Try and array details and events so readers experience the location in 3 dimensions. You can write, out past the window, a tree waved in the wind, or she spoke from across the room and we're there. Austere timing. Start your scenes at the last possible instant, cutting out all action tangential to the main point. End them as soon after the action's possible. Such clean use of scene setting usually happens in the final, scene setting usually happens in the final drafts of writing, because the writer must have a precise sense of the work's flow and destination to choose properly. Emotional weight. Scenes can convey and authenticate irrational, emotional, nuanced information more efficiently than explanation. As a writer, you should explore the power of sharing complexity with your readers. Opening up readers' comprehension in this way is liberating. Set scenes also convey a level of accuracy. Stuff does happen, that scene-free writing can only point toward. When I need to include a scene that I didn't observe but must glean from interviews, I say to people I'm interviewing, listen, the next 15 minutes of our conversation will be hard work and not normal. I want you to work with me as though we're 2 carpenters. I need parts to assemble. They aren't haplessly yammering while I take things down, but become complicit helpers in building the scene and create the story with me. I interview helpful sources first, get the basics of what's happened, then move on to adversarial sources. The best scenes grow from fine-grained research. Even observed scenes are often partial reconstructions, including information and details you don't catch at the time of the event. The final section of my book, Three Farms, focuses on a 20,000-acre parcel of a huge corporate farm in California. Although I knew the farm, I was kept under tight watch. I had even bought new farm executive-like clothes for my interviews, so I would blend in with the agricultural executives. I thought perhaps I was passing, but I later found out that the farm manager had told his staff, "Watch out for Kramer, he's got communist shoes." I had worn beat-up old shoes in a land of polished wingtips. I learned my lesson, but it wasn't to imitate better. Now I just act like myself, no matter who I'm interviewing. I secured closest access to a mid-level executive, meaning the one who made the $100,000 decisions, not the $1 million ones. After about a year of visiting the farm, there was a financial shakeup. Nearly all the workers I'd followed were fired. I called my insightful editor, Dick Todd, then of the Atlantic Monthly, which was publishing part of the book. "It's a disaster," I said to him, and he replied, "Is there a liquor store nearby?" And I said, "Do you want me to drown my sorrows?" And he said, "No, I want you to buy champagne and celebrate, you'll see." So I wrote up that section of the book, about 30,000 words. I flew back to California. I invited five of the former field executives to a meeting. I carried in a case of beer, actually two. For 5 hours, stopping and starting, I read them my draft of the entire section about their farm. They corrected every inaccuracy. They explained what I had misunderstood. They told me where I was fooled. They deepened the scenes with more information. They gave me a great gift. I'd seen a field of carrots being plowed under, but hadn't made it past front office double talk about the reason for it. It turned out that someone had forgotten to press an executive button on a harvest decision. And in that California heat, the carrots grew 3 inches too long for supermarket carrot bags. The farm accountant calculated that it was cheaper to plow under 100 million carrots than trim 100 million carrots to fit in the bags. I'd also written an elaborate scene of pruning valuable almond and pistachio trees. They must be tended and irrigated for years before yielding. My new advisor told me the pruning had been done wrong, delaying the tree's yield for a year, which cost a lot. I described a pesticide spraying scene, but hadn't known it was too much of the wrong chemical, and it was a $300,000 mistake. These scenes ended up observed and recreated, and were much better for it. Optimal preparation for scene writing begins with reporting specifically to gather the scene-building materials. Recreated and recollected scenes done with honor and craftsmanship work wonders, but the strongest, fullest, and most delicately built scenes follow field reporting that is attentive to sensory data, idiosyncratic quotes, pacing, personality, mood, odd but telling detail. Then you have everything. And through cunning selection, you can build scenes that are efficient, strong, and simple. And the book is full of that. I'm reading me, but 50 people could read pithy scenes like that. Let me turn things over to Jay. And that's all.
it's a wonderful collection. I'm going to buy it for my friends, and you should do the same. I'm going to talk a little bit, naturally enough, maybe about voice. I want to read just a tiny thing from my little contribution here. Also something from Susan Orlean. It's interesting to me to think about voice as something that you can't hear, since all my work is in radio and voice is a literal phenomenon. I'm working now on a series called This I Believe that airs on NPR, and we've gotten the instructive thing about voice here is we ask everybody to submit essays, and we just today passed the 25,000 mark of people who've sent in 500 word essays. These are not writers, but they're people trying to tell true stories. And in working with, two interesting things happen. One is directing them when we've selected these people to read for our series. And how to connect them to their own voice through their own words. And it's not as easy as you might think. People have a hard time finding out how they sound because they need to think about how they should sound or how they want to sound or all the expectations that are on them. And connecting a person's words to their actual voice is a sort of a theatrical director's task, which is what I undertake on the phone with these people and bringing them out. And it's been amazing because it's been everyone from, you know, Nobel scientists to nurses and construction workers, and so much of it comes through whether what they've written to begin with contains their voice. And the essays that we get them on the website, they come in and they're written the way they, that many of them have gone through draft after draft after draft. And then we have a spot called Reflections, and this is the, for those of you that are in the crowd of the writers, and the lesson I take away is so often they'll write the essay, and the essay will be that which they want to have others see. And then in Reflections, they begin so often saying, what I really wanted to say was. And then the essay starts at that point. And it's astonishing how often it occurs and how much more true and authentic the reflections are once they're off stage, once they're sitting down and talking. So I'll read you a couple little things I really like. And one from, I'm going to read something of Marx too. Radio gets inside us. Lacking ear lids, listeners are defenseless, vulnerable to ambush. Radio documentary makers have this tactical advantage over our colleagues in print, film, television, photography. Our tool is the oral story, the most primitive and powerful. Invisibility is our friend. Prejudice is suspended while our audience sits blind, receiving our story. That's what one thing I like about this This I Believe series is the way there is no prejudice against what you see. You just take in the ideas. Radio journalists understand that radio is inherently narrative. Radio occupies time. Our audience can't put it down and come back later. Radio journalists must hold on to listeners, so we have to perform. Print journalists who move to radio should know that. They are signing up to be performers. We have to create our own stage and then populate it with characters. I want to jump to Susan Orlean because she talks about voice. She's talking about writing, but I think it's interesting in light of this notion of occupying time and holding the stage and getting people to hear the actual you. This is from a section on voice in this book. Susan Orlean writes, developing a writer's voice is almost a process of unlearning, one analogous to children's painting. Young children often create fabulous paintings only to be told that after they start school that real houses don't look that way. At that point, most people lose their ability to be visually creative. Truly great painting retains some element of a child's emotional authenticity. Great writing does too. Self-analysis is crucial in developing a strong voice. Who am I? Why do I write? Your identity and your self-understanding become subliminal parts of your writer's voice, especially in long-form narrative writing. Imagine yourself telling friends about a story that excites you. Your friends follow the story, even though it's not linear, but circles back as you tell it. The way you tell a story over dinner is true to who you are, whether that is deeply analytical or extremely witty. At such moments, you aren't self-conscious. You aren't thinking about your editor. You can't invent a voice. And you can't imitate someone else's voice, though trying can be a good exercise. It can lead you to begin to understand the mechanisms that convey voice. Read your stories out loud so you can hear how you tell stories. Read your, as you read, ask yourself, does it sound real? Would I have said it that way? If the answer to either of these questions is no, you have done something wrong. I find that sometimes when I give readings of my published work, I skip parts that seem boring to me. Then I wonder, would it have been better to edit that out in the first place? When you read aloud, extraneous material falls away. Voice is, as the word itself tells us, the way a writer talks. You are speaking to your readers. And then I'm going to just read a last little thing from Mark. Mark, we have this website called transom.org where we give out the tools to tell your own stories on the radio. And it's a really remarkable site. It's the only website that ever won a Peabody Award in broadcasting. And it's been, you know, all the great radio storytellers, Chris Lydon in the back of the room there, Ira Glass, Studs Terkel, Norman Corwin, filmmakers like Errol Morris, writers like Mark, come and hold forth for a month and talk about their craft. And then there's also lots of stuff about, you know, whether this is the tape recorder you should buy or something different. And so I recommend that site to you. Also, PRX, the Public Radio Exchange, was sort of spawned by Transom. It's a way to get your work to public radio stations around the country. And we've just started something called the Public Radio Talent Quest, where if you have an ambition to be the next great host on public radio, you may go there and win that contest, publicradioquest.org. Anyway, this is Mark writing as a writer about radio, but also a little bit about just voice in general. And he's writing on transom.org. There's no single rule, but the most successful common practice is to construct a personable public voice, one that shows aloofness from public influence, shows wisdom and toughness, moderation and geniality, and plenty of savvy about worldly issues, shows that there's a real person with a whole sensibility, none of it stored for the duration, chatting with you. In short, it's the sort of voice you might be delighted to hear at 11 p.m. at a dinner party of fairly good friends and their friends, starting to tell an anecdote about a trip taken, a stranger encountered, mishap endured. It's polite, kindly, and informed, but it's also public, not inappropriately intimate or presumptuous or even imposing of biases or beliefs upon the listener. A strong voice narrator's companionability opens up structural choices. If you went to a museum with a boring official guide, you'd plod along this painting, that painting, this painting. But if you went with a brilliant and playful art historian friend, she might say, hey, look at this painting here. Now let's run upstairs, keep the smile from that first painting in mind. Here, in the corner, see this other smile? Okay, store that away, and now I'm gonna show you three cityscapes. But keep those smiles in mind, because I'm gonna ask you a question, etc. And because you trust and appreciate the savvy of your guide, you delight in the experience of accepting a directed, bumpy structure that actually leads somewhere. And a delightful and adventurous structure that holds interest and leads somewhere depends on a strong voice. Anyway, buy this book. And you want to answer questions? Or
I want to say one or two short more things and answer questions. I want to, the way we conceived this, we were each going to quote somebody else, and I didn't do that part of it, but it fits very well with what Jay said. Thomas Tizon, a West Coast journalist for the LA Times these days, wrote a piece here called Every Profile is an Epic Story, and his second point, I guess, is first point. Your subject is as complicated as you are. It's very easy for journalists to create one-dimensional characters in their stories, especially when they consider only the person's official role as soldier, mayor, victim, robber. To avoid that, I think about the mass of contradictions that I am and try to remember that others are too. This helps me guard against sentimentality and simplicity. Each person has a dark side. Once you get in, I also had Susan Orlean's voice beginning tagged, but once you open up to that much complexity, the job of composition becomes sudden, and choice becomes suddenly vast and complicated, and of course, tremendously exciting. And I want to quote the wonderful newspaper narrative journalist Ann Hull, who's in here, who is one of the two Washington Post reporters who did the Walter Reed story that's all over the papers and to such marvelous effect. And this is one of her pieces here called Revising Over and Over Again. My view of drafting is, as I learned from an old teacher, is that the first draft is shoveling clay from the clay seam in the riverbank. And only in subsequent drafts do you even begin to sculpt. And each draft solves a bunch of problems and exposes the next layer of problems. And the difference between an amateur and a professional writer, between a writer who wants to write and one who can and does, is frequently number of drafts, not some extra gift or some extra level of talent or insight. The talent is in the process. It's quite amazing how this works. There are two universities where I've been writer in residence for a decade each, teaching a course for the best writers, and in each of these classes of 10 or 12 students, there were two or three who could become national level writers. Now, if you figure that out and multiply it by the number of universities and the number of semesters and the defectiveness of my sampling system, and how few writers there are, how few people are crazy enough to actually do this, it should give you the news that a lot of the talent of writing is in the redrafting. And if you are one of those people who has to do it. This will save you a few years. So shall we open to questions? Can you identify yourselves or make up a name if you want anonymity when you do? And we'll try to repeat the questions because we're being broadcast.
I'm Rod Kessler. I teach creative nonfiction this semester at Salem State College. I'm not sure how to formulate this question, but when you began your remarks, you talked about how odd it would be to be at Starbucks and hear the neighbor talk about the fire in the same language of the newspaper article. And Jay, when you were talking about voice, you made a similar point that it sounds like there's a trend towards writing that's much more like voice than writing that's somehow more literary. Let me give an example. There are certain constructions that we would never use in our ordinary speech, and we wouldn't start speaking by a participial phrase. Walking down Mass Ave, I ducked into the Harvard bookstore. It's awkward. There's also certain vocabulary that we don't use in our speech. I might leave, but I'm not going to depart. Depart's the written word. Well, this is the point John McWhorter made when he spoke here, that he seems to claim that our language is shifting more towards a voiced English rather than a literary one. And what do you think about that? Do you think that's true?
Well, I think that critics have noticed for 40 or 50 years the grace of low speech, the grace of austere speech. But I think what's increased in the common public communication of magazine articles and the best newspaper journalism is admitting the reader to a sense of self-consciousness, a sense that you know what kind of language you're using, what kind of vocabulary you're using, that you know that you're in communication with the reader, that you're not just a dutiful essayist or a dutiful reporter. That sense of individual sensibility is now admissible and even necessary, and it's a tremendous advantage because it allows you to share confidences. It allows you to share, to broaden the set of emotions that you can refer to, and you don't have to. It's easiest when you're speaking to somebody only of your ethnicity, class, religious persuasion, education level, or something like that. I mean, you can imagine that the problem of reporters for papers that are multi-ethnic, multi-education level, multi-belief, multi-religiosity. Is enormous, and one solution is to retreat to only those utterances that are of pleasure to everybody or of necessity to everybody in their capacity as citizens. But another way is to say, hey, I'm a duck-footed Jewish intellectual, kind of like Woody Allen, you know, and I'm going to tell you a story. And then it doesn't matter if you're a Muslim priest or a lyrical custodian with a fourth grade education and a lot of street smarts, you know that kind of person. You can follow that story, and it tremendously broadens the voice that you can use. So all sorts of postures are possible. Your level of formality is absolutely key signal to give to readers, but it doesn't mean go low. It means go aware. And anormative syntax is frequently the signal for awareness, since you don't have faces or hands or asides. And also, it's true, sentences have lots of asides in them, of positives inside of hyphens, which have come up in the world, and just the scene of addressing the topic and turning to the reader and turning back is a level switch and a formality level switch. So it's a complicated subject and a wonderful question.
Yeah, I work in a medium where the voice is, where it's required that there be some off-the-pageness. But I think you're listening to a mind as much as you're listening to a voice. And in fact, as I direct people, I'm really trying to get them to think of the words rather than read them. So if I'm directing William F. Buckley, his language reflects his mind, and he would say walking down Mass Ave, but it comes out of him authentically. The problem is when people attempt to write in the way they feel they should be writing, or perhaps were instructed badly to write, and then you can hear it, you can hear them trip on it, they hang on it. When I'm working with them, I can feel the moments that aren't genuine to their mind. And then the voice follows that.
Mm-hmm. you mentioned earlier, TV is too powerful to change its voice, to stop speaking journalese. If it's that powerful, why can't it do what it wants? I'd love you to address that.
TV is too powerful to change its voice. If it's so powerful, why can't it do what it wants? I go second.
Well, people can change TV. I mean, I was my friend Ira Glass, who has the radio show This American Life, has just ventured into television, and his way of talking on the radio is not the way people spoke on the radio prior to the advent of his program. And he chose to speak in a different tone and to allow voices that were not the customary broadcast voices. I mean, up until, well, there are some exceptions, but generally in public radio, there was a way of talking. And he kind of single-handedly broke that up. And I think when you see his TV pilot on Showtime, you'll see that he's found with collaborators another way to use that language and to arrange the images differently than we're accustomed to seeing them. And all the usual and expected techniques of, say, cutaway to the interviewer listening. I mean, when you, what's fascinating about that is that he did a live show where they showed that showed him being cut away to listening to an interview, and the falseness of it was so shocking that the whole audience kind of burst out with a recognition that we've gotten accustomed to that as being true when we know it's simply to cover an edit in a in an interview, and yet we accept it. And to see him do it because he's so kind of relentlessly needing to be real was like a travesty. And then it made you realize all the travesties we accept all the time in television and in radio, for that matter. All the conventions that we just buy into as makers as much as listeners, because we think that's how it's done. And the trick is to reimagine it all altogether.
I want to be consistent. Can you say who you are and from where? And so?
I'm Jenny Atiyah. I'm an independent journalist.
Very.
I guess I say thank you. I'm not sure if that's okay.
It should be. I want to answer that too, because when you say why can't it do what it wants, of course the I presume there's an embedded notion, I hope wry, that it wants to be as real and natural as possible. I think it wants to sell as much commercial space for as high prices as possible. There's a dialectic in journalism between the pure intentions of reporters and the entertainment values imposed upon them as a business condition by those who control the vessels in which they report. Journalists discovered, arguably by the 1850s, that if they presented a moderately candid zone of purity, promised hands off, we won't influence it politically too much, we won't mess with the prerogatives of the people within it, they will be in an honor profession like priests and doctors and teachers, that the real estate around the zone of purity has tremendous value. And certainly the shareholders or CEOs or controlling families or whoever controls the big media want to make as much money as possible. They don't. Their job is not to be as truthful as possible. Truth is frequently community disintegrative. And the goal within the honor system, this is another reason, within the of this honor profession is to bind the community. They praise the opera house, they're fans of the local team, they participate culpably in the creation of the Olympus of celebrities with whom we pair up in our lonely bowling alone lives. This is what reporters do, as it seems natural. Oh boy, I got an interview with a celebrity. And they also reveal scandals and bring down, address power with truth and do all that other stuff. It's very complicated. It's not a simple set of roles. It's really complicated. Some of the, TV in particular doesn't accept material through the same intake system that newspapers do. There are a number of Nieman fellows here who can pretty much sit down at their typewriter and write something and put it in the newspaper with the clearance of an editor who they can understand, and if they want to adventure a little, and they have the heft of their great ability, they can do it. But I'll be damned if anybody can say, hey, I want to put this on TV and go to NBC and put it on TV. That's very guarded terrain, and it's guarded for commercial reasons. And when they pay Katie Couric a lot and her ratings drift downward a little bit, they tinker with this pure mission of telling the public the truth about what's going on. And I will close this answer by recalling a journalist you've heard of who was a friend telling me, hey, during the Michael Jackson trial, one of the executives from my station came in and said, we want 50% Jackson for the first 4 days. Okay. I don't think that that could happen in a newspaper. Chris?
Jay was quoting you, Mark, I guess, on this on the radio voice of the dinner party at 11 o'clock. And I wasn't quite sure how you happened to write that or what you wanted to learn us to learn from it.
Oh,
I was just intrigued by that.
Okay. It's a really... I think the answer might be interesting. No, I've learned as a storyteller, you never say, this is a great story, because you can only fail.
We'll be the judge of that.
I know you will. I'm sure you will. And a good judge. After 10 or 15 years of teaching, I stumbled upon a strategy. I have a big pile of students who apply for the class. I select 10 of them or something like that. And I say to them, I want you to come to the first class having in mind for oral telling a story that you've dined out on, a story that you love, that you've told for so many years that people buy you dinner happily when you tell it. And what comes out matches this description. And it's not the kind of story you get when you sit down on an airplane next to somebody who starts telling you about his divorce and then tells you, as somebody did me, that he has a neurological habit of picking his scalp until it bleeds, and he hopes you don't mind, and so on. It's touching the listener or reader on their public space. It's saying, pardon me, have you got a match? Not, pardon me, have you got a match? Or, pardon me, have you got a match? Convention, which I derive from common practice of book-length, individually voiced literary journalism, is a medium level of formality. So I say to them, you're at a party, it's 11 at night, you've had three glasses of pretty good red wine, and you hear yourself saying, speaking of X, that reminds me of. And you're poised, you know that everybody at the party is quite witty and quite informed and quite sane and quite educated and quite courteous and waiting for you to I mean, you've said what the terrifying thing, the 12-year-old boys, I got one of them, says, throw the ball to me, I can do it. It's a great moment, but it's not no holds barred, and it's not a fire yesterday at the corner. There's a gradient of formality on many scales, and that's one of them.
But not to be too flattering, but I think your radio show embodies exact quality. And we follow your interests, and you guide it, and you listen, and you take this or that diversion and have that quality of enthusiasm.
Thank you. Suddenly I thought, what is it? He's describing what I'm supposed to be trying to do.
More questions, please. And by the way, if you want to talk about your projects, we kind of expected and welcome that. Not you. Can you identify yourself, please?
Sure. My name is Chris Cleary, and I live here in Cambridge. I work at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And my job there is I have the honor and privilege of listening to cancer patients tell their stories. And I write it or I help them write it. So, but I also have some of my own stories to tell. And my question really has more to do with publishing than writing. And I have, lots of essays that I write. my topic generally is about memory, what it means to remember a person. And I don't know where to go with them. I tried this, I believe, and wrote something that, you know, I showed to a number of writers, and everyone said, this is really good, you know, you should send it to this, I believe. And I did. You didn't pick it.
Okay. It doesn't mean we have, you know, I'll tell you one thing, the greatest catalyzing event for writing of this, I believe, essay is cancer. And it's astonishing to us the number of essays that come in where, well, people are evaluating their own cancer or cancer of people they love. It's just overwhelming. Which only from an editorial standpoint is right. Just difficult because you say, oh, you know, at NPR, they go like that.
The same is true in over the transom publishing submissions, too. So that such a submission has to say, I'm sure you get a lot of cancer submissions, but.
Well, this, I believe, wasn't necessarily about that.
And it may still be being reviewed, so don't lose heart. Well, maybe not. But I'll check on it.
The cruelty of this world with our national mass media is that there's nowhere near enough room for all the talent around.
I know.
You have to be a bully and an opportunist and a savvy player, really. I mean, luck happens, but it's frequently abetted by unseemly ambition, too.
Well, are there other places for something like what you do? So your beautiful essay isn't chosen by this, I believe. Is there any other place to go?
Well, I would think there are lots and lots of places to go. I mean, it depends sort of on what you're trying to do, whether your interest is in that particular essay and getting that out, and whether you find a place that, you know, is in sync with that and you work hard to do that, or whether you're trying to, whether that's part of you as a writer and it becomes one thing of many. And, you know, a lot of people these days are well read and discovered in their, on their blogs. I mean, they have better readership than they might have if they got it published in a magazine, and I wouldn't sniff at that.
What about independent productions ending up on PRX?
Yeah, I mean, you can voice these things yourself and put them on the PRX.org. Lots of people do that.
And you know what happens then? It's a terrific website. People will listen to it, and if it's terrific, somebody will say, hey, that new one that was posted yesterday is terrific, and some more people will list it, and soon it'll be picked up by some stations.
If it's something you can voice, you can submit it to your local public radio station, BUR. Tony Khan's Morning Stories here on WGBH, I think it's... would be, I mean, you do some research and find out, but, you know, that's only one piece, whatever it is, and it's about the overall persistent effort.
Okay.
And after I'll get your name, I will check on it, make sure.
And I'll get your name, too, and hear more about the book about memory. Because I do publishing stuff sometimes.
I'm Sean Beege, a freelance writer, and actually starting a blog right now called Conversations, Etc., just interview-based blog. And as a freelance writer, as a teacher...
Where do you teach?
I was teaching in juvenile hall, English and creative writing, to teach adult ed. Anyway, I'm just a gatherer of stories, and I was wondering, for each of you, a voice you can't get out of your head of someone you know that you've written about, and two, a story you want to cover.
One that I just wrote the email last night. A lot of people cross my path just because I'm sort of out there trying to help people tell their own stories. And this, I believe, all these projects are in a way that. And the this, I believe, from last week was written by a Chinese American who is a epidemiologist who works at a recovery center in New Hampshire for post-traumatic stress disorder and returning vets from Iraq. And his essay is about his belief in man's innate potential for brutality. It was really quite a striking essay. But I sort of can't get him out of my mind, so I've been writing with him the last few days to say I'd like to undertake some sort of a documentary film, or I also do television about post-traumatic stress and returning vets, and his, and I thought I might work with him to figure out what's the story that that profession thinks needs to be told.
There's a writer named Richard Rhodes, won a Pulitzer for The Making of the Atomic Bomb. He wrote a much less popular and probably much less compelling for most people book called Farmer. And if you, it's a year's round of a wheat farmer, I think, in Kansas, Oklahoma, somewhere like that, where he's from. And while you're reading it, you get restless. You want to go over to the window and look out. Has anybody read this strange document? And you asked very specifically about a voice you can't get out of your mind. And I realized after a while that he'd done a trick in there. He'd narrowed the range of observations to those his main, it's in third person, but he narrowed the range of observations to those his character might have had. It's very interesting. I don't want to go like this when you're reading it. As for projects I would love to be able to do, I would like to have free access to the daily life and explanations of it of the CEO of a major corporation. It's just, it's impossible. As soon as you try to do that, the lawyers come up and tell you that, tell him that it is a fiduciary responsibility not to let you anywhere near there. And I've come close. I've had one CEO tell me that if I would make a secret deal with him to share my manuscript, he wanted the notoriety. But I'm still hoping that somebody near retirement or something will, on a lark, do that, because here you have a conglomerate that holds hundreds of companies, each of which has a brilliant director or is soon replaced by one. And yet the whole thing depends on some, I think it would be such a some notional sense of how things run. I think it would be so revealing to have access to that. There are many blank spots on the map that's covered. I romanced a prominent local murder attorney and said, I want to be in from the first phone call. And he said, this is great fun. I have confidence in your work and I want to do it. And his partner told him that he'd be taken out and shot if he did it, that I could be subpoenaed even if he couldn't. I would be a violation of the attorney-client privilege. And the same thing for all sorts of crucial politicians, all sorts of crucial people in crucial jobs. I think that the toughest beat on a newspaper is the business reporting for that very reason. And it doesn't acknowledge that. You can read the business section even of the Times or the Globe or one of the better papers for years and never quite wake up to that. And yet it's there. And it's terribly important for us to know that. It's called a radical idea now, but it's you know, sort of like a demand to know what Dad does for a living.
One or two more questions?
We do. It's snowy night. Stay here till the thaw. Are there more questions?
I'll squeeze one in if I can. I'm wondering what your voice is. You said you can't invent one.
Well, Susan Orlean said you can't invent one. I actually think that the act is better than the person. That you do in that sense improve on things. That's one of the advantages of not being a dancer or an improv artist, is that you can edit yourself, and to that extent you can sculpt the block of wood that has you in it. And the, I don't know, this is a metaphor in the process of failing, but I think you can improve on yourself in the written word.
So can you say what your voice is?
I think I did when I answered Chris's question about the knowing, savvy, mature friend. It's much better than me.
I understand.
But there are other voices. I mean, Susan Orlean's famous essay on the boy at the age of 10. Or Richard Rhodes is the one I described for Richard Rhodes, or Tom Wolfe's excited voice, which nevertheless doesn't leave conservative probity far behind. There are many voices, and you do have to find yours, and it's not completely, it doesn't just come out, it is invented and constructed. You have some control over it.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that you have just one, and you have many moods, you have many occasions, you have, and there is an element of performance here too. So there you have persona. I think the thing that the measurement that I make is, am I bullshitting or am I boring myself? And sometimes I figure out that I am bullshitting or boring myself too late.
It was broadcast yesterday.